The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports, and some miscellaneous stuff, too. As I've indicated before, the new magazines we read, they're cutting way back, and we've got double issues and all kinds of things that are complicated. So I pulled some stuff that I think is of interest that's similar to what's in Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. So we may be doing some of those over the next couple of days, since we're about ready to run out of information on the magazines. But I think you'll find them interesting. They're kind of Reader's Digest-y kind of things. And the first one we're going to look at is 20 food-related culture shock tourists had when they visited the U.S. that I honestly can't blame them for. Lots of people complain about how bland American food is, but in my experience, these are the people who eat McDonald's in America, then wonder why it's no different from back home, and that's by Claudia Santos. We all know that by now, how and what we eat in the U.S. can be a bit surprising to those visiting. My parents moved to the States in the 80s and are still baffled that they had to pay $9 for a cup of coffee, and don't even get it started on my French boyfriend's obsession with refills. After hearing about the culture shocks in my own circle, I wanted to ask the BuzzFeed community, and that's what we're reading from, what they found particularly strange about how Americans eat. I even did a deep dive on Reddit. Here were their responses. I've been living in America for 4 years, and I'm still not used to having a real meal for lunch. My husband is always like, just make yourself a sandwich. And I can't understand that back home, we ate rice, beans, and red meat for lunch every day. A sandwich just doesn't make any sense for me. It's one of the big cultural differences in our relationship. Number two, people eating on paper plates at home and baking foods in disposable field containers? They drink the grossest thing I've ever tasted, root beer. Actually, I happen to like root beer. I find it sad that many Americans have lunches in front of their computer screen at their desk. Lunch is a communal affair in India, where six and seven of us will sit together, share each other's food, and make a meal of it. The fifth thing is most Americans switch their knives from hand to hand depending on whether they're cutting or eating their food. They'll move the knife to their dominant hand to cut, and then transfer the knife back to the other hand so they can hold a fork with their dominant hand. I just keep my fork in one hand and the knife in the other at all times, and all Europeans do the same. They don't switch when they're cutting things on their plates. I really don't understand why right-handed Americans do it that way. It's so much extra work. Number six, how fast the average American eats. They eat like they're trying to beat the clock or win a contest. Number seven, I find many, but not all Americans who have grown up eating a lot of processed food won't try the real, in parentheses, version or complain it doesn't taste the same. For example, box mac and cheese is always going to be different than homemade, but so many won't even give it a shot because it isn't what they're used to. Number eight, the high quality of takeout and fast food in some places. I went to some random sandwich shops in Washington, D.C., and it was just the best. Unfortunately, that was almost 20 years ago. But even many times since that I've gone back to grab a quick pick while in the country and have gotten some absolutely delicious food. And then there's the In-N-Out. That's a whole other level. Number nine, Australian here. Lots of people complain about how bland American food is. But in my experience, these are the people who eat at McDonald's in America and then wonder why it's no different from back home. America has some awesome barbecue. One of the best pieces I have ever had, probably a close second to the one in Naples, was in a little sports pub in Breckenridge, Colorado. It could be really surprising just how good the food in America is, contrary to popular belief, and you don't have to look very hard to find it. Number 10, the whole coffee process. Why does it take 20 minutes to make a coffee? Why do Americans, in my experience anyway, not have kettles? The coffee pot is so confusing to me, and having to mess around with filters? Also, why do they hate tea? Tea is lovely! Number 11, how sweet the bread is. We had to search and search for bread without sugar in it. Number 12, I found putting butter on popcorn or the cinnamon to be the strangest thing. But honestly, this is the main reason I go to the movies. Number 13, my Swedish fiancé was in the U.S. for the second time a few years ago, and we went to Olive Garden. We ordered more than we could eat because we wanted to try several things. And I wanted to get a go box, also called a doggy bag, and take the rest home like I always do when I have leftovers at restaurants. He was so mortified at this that he begged me not to and said it would be so embarrassing. Apparently, asking to take your leftover home is akin to asking to wash the dishes instead of paying in Sweden. Number 14. I did a little road trip around California a few years back. We were staying in the Lake Tahoe area and dropped in at this breakfast place to eat. It was about 9 a.m. or so. There were people having full-on steaks and fries for breakfast. It just blew my mind. Number 15. Drink refills. In the U.K., refills aren't a thing. In the U.S., a server will swipe your drink off your table without a word and refill it when you reach the halfway point. Number 16. The color of stuff, like Fruit Loops. We have it here in Canada, but it's not as bright and vibrant as is in the U.S. The intensity of the dyes is simply astonishing and, quite frankly, a little disturbing. Why do you need to have all the colors of the rainbow on your plate to convince you to eat your food? Number 17. We were served a fruit salad, and it had marshmallows in it. Really confusing texture, and it was far too sweet for me. But after a few spoons, I got used to it and thought it was pretty good. Not missing it much, though. Number 18. The first time I went to Cheesecake Factory, I ordered meatloaf, and a platter was put before me that would have served to my family of five. Delicious, but really excessive. Number 19. The amount of sugar that Americans consume. My cousins live in the U.S., and it makes me nauseous when I see how they drink their coffee. 4 to 5 teaspoons of sugar, 3 to 5 cups a day. So you do the math. And number 20. Drinking and alcohol in public being frowned upon or forbidden and resulting in use of paper bags in which the bottles are wrapped. Is there anything else about food culture that completely shocked you as a non-American? Let us know. I'm pretty sure these 63 facts I learned are going to be the most fascinating things you'll read all day. When Mario Puzo, the author of the Godfather books, began to adapt novels to film, he had never written a screenplay before. Although he ended up winning 2 Oscars for his scripts, he decided to purchase a book on screenwriting in order to further perfect his craft. Puzo said he was shocked when he started reading the book. The first chapter of the book said, "Study Godfather 1. It's the model of a screenplay," he said. "So I was stuck with the book." During the first seasons of Saturday Night Live in 1976, producer Lorne Michaels delivered an on-camera plea to the Beatles, inviting them to the studio to reunite and joking that NBC would offer them $3,000 for a performance. Turns out that Paul McCartney and John Lennon were actually watching the show together when Michaels performed the bit. In 1980, Lennon revealed that they actually considered going to the studio. "We nearly got into a cab, but we were actually too tired," he said. "He and I were just sitting there watching the show, and we went, ha-ha, wouldn't it be funny if it went down?" In later years, McCartney corroborated the story. "It would have been work, and we were having a night off, so we'd elected not to go," he said. "It was a nice idea, and we nearly did it." Number 2. In 1959, Walt Disney invited then-Vice President Richard Nixon and his family to Disneyland to attend the dedication ceremony for all of the park's new monorail. The monorail's air conditioning only worked when the train was in motion. On the day the Nixon family arrived to tour the monorail, it was reportedly very hot, so Disney invited them to the air-conditioned car, and the train took off with the family on board. The issue? Nixon's Secret Service staff was left on the platform as the train left, essentially kidnapping the vice president and his family. After the train completed the first lap, it appeared to slow down to let the Secret Service members on. Instead, Nixon's daughters allegedly yelled, "Again!" and the train went for a second lap without the Secret Service agents on board. Bob Gurr, the Disney employee in charge of the whole debacle, said that Nixon reportedly roared with laughter. The monorail eventually stopped, allowing the Nixon family to reunite with their Secret Service agents. It was later revealed that Disney executives were actually a bit worried about the Nixon family joyride. The monorail had only taken one successful lap before the Nixon family trip. According to Gurr, there were some concerns that the train might catch on fire with the entire Nixon family on board. Some people would say that probably wasn't a bad thing. The rhyme "Rock-a-bye Baby" might have been pretty dark origin. Some believe that the lullaby was written about the son of King James II of England and Mary of Modena, who allegedly was not actually the couple's biological son. And men said Many think that a random child was brought into the birthing suite and passed off as theirs in order to ensure that there would be a Roman Catholic heir to the throne. On December 8, 1963, Barry Keenan and Joe Amser, the former high school classmates from Los Angeles, kidnapped Frank Sinatra Jr. in order to demand a hefty ransom from his famous father. Keenan and Amser had reportedly been tailing Sinatra for weeks in order to determine when would be the best time to strike. Sinatra had been trying to get his own musical career started, and he was performing at Harris Club Lodge at Lake Tahoe on the night of the abduction. After the performance, Sinatra was resting in his dressing room with a friend when Keenan knocked on the door and pretended to be delivering a package. They tied up the friend while they blindfolded Sinatra and led him out of the room at gunpoint to a waiting car. The friend was able to free himself and contacted authorities, who quickly sprung into action and set up roadblocks to try and catch the kidnappers. According to the FBI report from the kidnapping, the kidnappers were actually stopped but ended up bluffing their way through the roadblocks and continued on to a hideout in Los Angeles. Less than an hour after the crime, the FBI contacted Sinatra's parents. They believed that the motive for kidnapping was money and advised the Sinatras to pay the ransom request so they could trace the money. Keenan, Amser, and a third conspirator, John Irwin, ultimately ended up demanding $240,000 in ransom. The Sinatras gave the FBI the money, who followed the instructions given by the kidnappers, and dropped the money between two school buses in Sepulveda, California, on December 11th. When Keenan and Amser were en route to pick up the money, Irwin got nervous and ended up freeing Sinatra Jr., who walked several miles until he found a security guard who could help him. The guard put Sinatra Jr. in the trunk of his car to avoid drawing attention and took him home. While he didn't know much about his kidnappers, he was able to give authorities enough information to lead them to the house. All three men involved were quickly captured, and nearly all of the ransom was recovered. During the trial, the defense attempted to argue that Sinatra Jr. actually orchestrated his own kidnapping as a publicity stunt, but a confession letter written by Keenan was eventually found. All three men were convicted. Keenan and Amser were both sentenced to life in prison plus 75 years, while Irwin was given 75 years. Their sentences were later reduced to 25 years. Amser and Irwin both served 3.5 years, while Keenan ended up serving 4.5. Upon Keenan's release, he entered the real estate world and became a multimillionaire. In 1998, he decided to sell his story for publication, and soon after, Columbia Pictures approached him and his co-conspirators, offering them millions to make a movie about the experience. After Sinatra Jr. caught wind of this, he filed a lawsuit, citing a California law stating that felons could not profit off their crimes. Keenan shot back, saying that the lawsuit violated his First Amendment rights. After a long battle, Sinatra Jr. won the case. Although Barbie and Ken might be one of the world's most popular fictional couples, they're low-key kind of siblings. Mattel founder Ruth Handler decided to name the dolls after her children, Barbara and Kenneth, which means that the couple was inspired by a real-life brother and sister duo. Oh, incest. Number 6. I firmly believe that Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On is one of the best movie theme songs of all time. That's interesting. I was just listening to that writing into today to make this recording. So I was utterly shocked to learn that the singer allegedly wanted no part of it at first. Before Titanic was released, it was the center of some pretty negative buzz. Studio executives thought that an addition of an epic love song would make a good marketing tool. Director James Cameron was reportedly against ending the movie with a pop song and allegedly told executives, "Would you put a song on the end of Schindler's List?" Meanwhile, composer James Horner, who had already been tapped to write the film's score, had been quietly working on My Heart Will Go On. Horner and Dion had already worked together, and he believed that Dion would be the perfect person to tackle the ballad. However, when he approached Dion with the song, she said she was skeptical to work on another movie after recording songs for Beauty and the Beast and Up Close and Personal. Eventually, her husband, the late René Angélil, persuaded her to record a demo. Behind closed doors, I think René told her this was going to be one of the biggest things in her career, record executive Tommy Mottola recalled to Billboard. Dion agreed to the demo recording. She laid down this vocal, nonstop, okay? One take, Mottola said. We were all getting chills. Dion said that everyone in the room was crying after she finished the song in just a single take. Although the demo went well, Dionne said she was still worried about what Cameron was going to think. James Cameron didn't want to have a song in his movie, she said. My movie is big enough. I don't need something bigger. I don't need any singer. After hearing the song, Cameron agreed that it worked well in the film. My Heart Will Go On went on to become one of the best-selling singles of all time and won the Oscar for Best Original Song, as well as Record of the Year at the Grammys. I'm so glad that my husband said, I really think that you should do that song, Dionne told Billboard in 2017. Number 7. A walrus's tusk size determines their social status, so size does matter. The longer the tusk, the more respected the walrus is. Both male and female walruses grow tusks that can measure up to 3 feet long. If the tusks break, it often means that their social status gets knocked down a few pegs. Number 8. In addition to, you know, being the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln was also a champion wrestler who was allegedly only defeated once over a dozen years of competition. Lincoln got his start wrestling as a child, where he reportedly competed in matches for over a decade. At age 19, Lincoln purportedly defended his stepbrother's river barge by using his wrestling skills to throw the hijackers overboard. Another one of Lincoln's notable wins came in 1830, when he was challenged to a fight by members of a gang while working as a shopkeeper in New Salem, Illinois. He ended up defeating Jack Armstrong, who was then the town's wrestling chaplain. Armstrong, who was allegedly fighting dirty, so Lincoln reportedly kicked him up, picked him up, and knocked him out to end the fight. In 1992, Lincoln was enshrined in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Oklahoma. We like to say wrestling is life, Executive Director Leroy Smith said, and he wrestled with life. It also turns out that Lincoln wasn't just a good wrestler, but a pretty athletic guy overall. He allegedly loved to play handball and was even spotted playing outside during the Republican National Convention when he was nominated to run for president. He also supposedly enjoyed bowling and billiards. In fact, Harold Hosler, a Lincoln historian and co-chairman of the Lincoln Forum, said that many would consider Lincoln what we would describe today as ripped. Number nine. Every year after the holidays, the lumber from the iconic Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center has been noted to Habitat for Humanity. The practice originated in 2007. Several of the homes that have been built using lumber from the tree have commemorative stamps on them acknowledging which year's tree the wood came from. Number 10. Before marrying Princess Charles, Princess Diana had several royal connections. In fact, her lineage tracing back to her great-great-granduncle, the 5th Earl of Spencer, who has some very fascinating royal roots. He allegedly worked as a groom of the stool, which meant that he helped the king wash up after using the bathroom. The groom would also carry around a portable toilet and closely monitor the royal's diet to get a better sense of when he had to use the bathroom. In addition to assisting with bathroom duties, the groom of the stool would also help the king dress up and ensure that his room was kept tidy. While this doesn't sound like the most glamorous royal role, it was allegedly a very coveted job. As the king would sit on the toilet, he would typically spill secrets to the groom of the stool, who would end up becoming one of the most connected people in the palace. In fact, the role was so prestigious that monarchs in exile were often denied grooms as part of their punishment. While grooms of the stool originated in the 1400s, the role became more popularized during Henry VIII's reign. By the 1800s, the groom of the stool position had evolved to eliminate all bathroom duties. Instead, the groom would help the king with his dressing and other personal grooming. With the ship, the job became known as the groom of the stole instead of the stool. That's interesting. Diana also allegedly had some pretty notable familial connections outside of the royal family. She was distantly related to Prime Minister Winston Churchill after Charles Spencer married Anne Churchill in the 1700s. In a rather American twist, Town and Country reported that George Worson is allegedly Diana's 8th cousin, 5 times removed. Audrey Hepburn and Diana were also distantly related, as Hepburn's mother was a member of the Dutch nobility. And finally, on the episode of PBS's Finding Your Roots, actor Glenn Close learned that she and Diana were 8th cousins. Number 11. While you definitely know about NASA's achievements in space, they've also developed quite a few items that you probably have in your home. Among NASA's non-space-related inventions are the Dustbuster, scratch-resistant glass lenses, athletic cooling fabrics, memory foam, and even elements of the modern laptop, including fan-based cooling and a full-size keyboard. Back when George Lucas was developing the storylines for the original Star Wars trilogy, He imagined them being a series of stories recorded by an ancient race of immortal beings known as the Wills. That's W-H-I-L-L-S. His plans was to have the Wills pass on the stories to groups of chroniclers known as keepers, who would record them in journals. In fact, Lucas said he originally intended an R2-D2 being one of the keepers. He also allegedly imagined he himself would be one of the keepers, in a way to connect the Star Wars world he created to reality. Although the idea of the Wills didn't make it into the final cut of the film, Lucas said he was able to salvage part of his work. The Wills became part of this massive amount of notes, quotes, background information that I used for the scripts. The stories were actually taken from the Journal of the Wills, he said. In fact, the Journal of the Wills inspired the movie's opening sequence. The recaps of past events at the beginning of the movies were meant to be entries from the journal, told the perspective from the Wills. In later years, the Wills made their official debut in Rogue One. Number 13. At the Lego Idea House in Denmark, there is an archive of all 8,000 Lego sets the company has released since the 1960s. The collection is part of the company's corporate museum and is closed to visitors unless they have business-relevant purposes. Christine Reber-Haug, a Lego historian, said that on the off chance visits are allowed in, the company recommends taking your birth year and adding 5 Legos in order to be reacquainted with Lego sets of your childhood. Number 14. While most Mad Men viewers likely knew that the series took a lot of cues from real-life events and ad campaigns, you might not have known that Don Draper, the show's main character, was allegedly partially based on a real person. Draper Daniels was an ad executive for Leo Burnett, an agency in Chicago, and was even credited with creating the Marlboro Man. In 2009, Myra Daniels, Draper's wife, wrote an essay for Chicago Magazine titled, I Married a Madman, where she revealed that Draper persuaded her to marry him after they met during a business meeting about a company merger, even though she was already engaged. Daniels added that after they were married, Draper became much different. Draper Daniels smoked a lot and sometimes drank his lunch, as Don Draper does on the show, she said. He had a lot of energy and enjoyed life and came up with brilliant and innovative ideas, traits shared with Don Draper. He also liked women, much the way Don Draper does. But the Draper Daniels I knew became a one-woman man after we married. He also quit drinking, when I told him I didn't want to work with a lush. She added that after Draper created the Marlboro Man, he ended up leaving advertising for a year because he felt so guilty about promoting cigarettes. Matthew Weiner, who created Mad Men, said that he was inspired by Draper's name when developing Don Draper and called Draper Daniels one of the great copy guys. In 1968, Pan Am, which was then one of America's most popular airlines, launched First Moon Flights Club, where customers could book their tickets for a first civilian flight to the moon. The projected to begin in 2000. The idea originated in 1964 after Gerhard Pfister, an Austrian journalist, walked into a travel agency and asked to book a flight to the moon. Instead of passing it off as a joke, the agent reported connected him with both Soviet Aeroflot and Pan Am, inspiring the airline to actually develop their program. In 1968, they enrolled about 100 people. When a Pan Am-branded spacecraft appeared in 2001, Space Odyssey, requests allegedly skyrocketed. Between 1968 and 1971, the airline accepted about 93,000 reservation requests, including some from pretty notable names, including politicians, entrepreneurs, and even a news anchor, Walter Cronkite. Everyone who enrolled in the program received a numbered membership card in the mail. Pan Am acknowledged that there were a lot of unresolved details regarding the flights. In a form letter sent to members, they wrote, starting date of service is not yet known. Equipment and route will probably be subject to government approvals. Fares are not fully resolved and may be out of this world. In 1971, the airline stopped taking reservations, citing administrative and financial strain. Despite the sudden halt in the program, Pan Am maintained that reservations were legitimate. Rival airlines like TWA said they were also keeping a list of customers for when they unveiled their own trips to the moon. But the Pan Am program reigned supreme in terms of popularity. In 1991, Pan Am shuttered after going bankrupt, thus officially voiding the 93,000 reservations. Well, since there are a whole bunch more of these and we don't have time to do all of them, I'm going to put a stop right now and let's go back and do some Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We can come back to these later. It's a win-win. Celebrating the personal victories of other people can bring on more of our own. When Eugenie George first heard that her friend passed a financial counseling exam, her heart sank. She'd failed the test weeks earlier, and she needed the credential to advance her career. "My inner child got upset," recalls George, a financial writer and educator from Philadelphia. But then, instead of suing, she called her friend. "I told her I failed and admitted I was jealous," she says. George knew that being upfront would diffuse her envy, but was surprised when it shifted her attitude so she could share her friend's happiness and experience her own in turn. "I congratulated her and told her she inspired me," she says. Finding pleasure in another person's good fortune is what social scientists call Freudenfreude, a term inspired by Freud, the German word for joy, that's F-R-E-U-D-E, that describes bliss we feel when someone else succeeds, even if it doesn't directly involve us. Freudenfreude is like social glue, says Catherine Chambliss, a professor of psychology at Yersinus College in Collegeville, that's an appropriate name, Collegeville, Pennsylvania. It makes relationships more intimate and enjoyable. Erica Weiss, an empathy researcher at Harvard University, says the feeling closely resembles positive empathy, the ability to experience someone else's positive emotions. A study in 2021 examined the positive empathy's role in daily life and found that it prevailed acts of kindness such as helping others. Sharing in someone else's joy can also foster resilience, improve life satisfaction, and help people cooperate during a conflict. While the benefits of Freudenfreude are so plentiful, it doesn't always come easily. In zero-sum situations, your loss might really sting, making Freudenfreude feel out of reach. If you were raised in a family that paired winning with self-worth, Chambliss says, you might misread someone else's victory as your own shortcoming. And factors such as mental health and overall well-being can also affect your ability to participate in someone else's joy. Still, indulging in Freudenfreude is worthwhile, and there are ways to encourage the feeling. To better understand Freudenfreude, it can be helpful to demystify its better-known counterpart, Schadenfreude, the pleasure we feel when witnessing someone else's misfortune. In 2012 study, Chambliss and her colleagues examined instances of Freudenfreude and Schadenfreude among college students, some of whom were experiencing mild depression. Freudenfreude scores were higher and Schadenfreude scores were lower among those who were not depressed. The mildly depressed college students, however, had a harder line adopting a joy-sharing mindset. When you're feeling down, it's natural to puncture positive news with negativity, Chambliss explains. And even when people aren't experiencing mental distress, moments of Schadenfreude, when a movie villain gets his comeuppance, for example, or a nemesis faces scrutiny, can be comforting and serve a purpose. Schadenfreude is one we try to cope with jealousy and vulnerability, says clinical psychologist Emily Ann Holt, co-founder of COA, a mental health app. It's an ego protector that shields people from pain and reinforces social bonds within a group. As when joy erupts among sports fans after their rival team faces humiliating loss. Indulging in too much Schadenfreude, however, can backfire. One study found that Schadenfreude on social media can ice out empathy, making people less compassionate toward those who differ from them. Other research suggests that delighting in the mishaps of others can actually lower people's self-esteem, especially when they compare themselves to high achievers. Empathy isn't always automatic reflex, Rice says. It's often motivated process. To help people strengthen joy-sharing muscles, Chambliss and her colleagues develop a program called Freudenfreude Enhancement Training, FET, featuring two exercises. They found that depressed college students who used the practices for 2 weeks had an easier time expressing Freudenfreude, which enhanced their relationship and improved their mood. If you're interested in enjoying more Freudenfreude, try the tips from below we're going to read, called from FET and advice from other expert sources. Show active interest in someone else's happiness. One way to summon good feelings for others is to ask questions. Chambliss and her colleagues call this practice SHOI, or sharing joy. To start, invite the bearer of good news to discuss the experience. Even if your heart isn't in it, research conducted by Sonia Lebaronsky, a psychology professor at the University of California, Riverside, who studies happiness, suggests that happiness can flourish when you make a heartfelt effort to engage with a positive activity. So when you speak with your friend, make eye contact and listen attentively. This should motivate you to keep going and make you feel as if your efforts will pay off with Freudenfreud. View individual success as a communal effort. When we feel happy for others, their joy becomes our joy, says psychologist Mario Sofranco, author of the book Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. To that end, Freudenfreud encourages us to look at success as community achievement. No one gets to the top alone, and when we elevate others, we're often carried up with them, Anhalt says. Jean Gray, an artist and self-identified multi-potentialite, supports friends and colleagues by adopting this mindset. When someone gets a new opportunity or reaches a milestone, she makes sure to celebrate. Gray says that she's especially moved when anyone considers others when anyone considered others succeeds. It's worth inspirational, she says, because it lifts us all up and makes us shine. Share credit for your success with others. Because emotions are contagious, showing appreciation can increase Freudenfreud for the gratitude giver and the recipient. In this way, you can think of Freudenfreud as something you can spread when you're experiencing personal joy. To do this, try an FET exercise called Bragitude, which involves expressing gratitude when someone else's success or support leads to your own. Start by sharing your win. Then tell the other person how you appreciate the help. Be specific. If your friend's accountant advised you to squirrel away more money, for instance, you might say, "My savings are growing. Thanks for recommending your great accountant." Practice Bragitude. It's like sharing dessert. Both parties enjoy the sweetness of the moment, which enhances Freudenfreud for both of them. And turn into a joy spectator. Very often we think of joy passively, Franco says. We see it as something that comes to us instead of something we can generate. But you don't need to wait for someone else's good news to exercise Freudenfreud. Cultivate joy by inviting others to share their victories. You might ask, what was the bright spot in your day? Or could I use some good news? What's the best thing that happened to you this week? Asking about other people's wins turns you into a joy spectator, giving you a chance to witness them at their best. Experience more Freudenfreud doesn't mean you'll never root against a villain again, but being able to reach for happiness is inherently beneficial. As delicious as it is to delight in our enemy's defeat, Shambliss says, celebrating our friend's successes, big and small, helps us all triumph in the end. Diverging digits. Counting on your fingers is such a natural thing to do that you might assume it's the same everywhere. But while you probably start counting with your index finger and end with your thumb, in many parts of Europe they start counting with the thumb and finish with the pinky. In Iran, they begin with the pinky, whereas in Japan, they start with the fingers extended in an open palm, drawing them in to make a closed fist. That's an interesting factoid. Now on to Consumer Reports. Canned vegetable hacks you wish you knew sooner. While canned foods today aren't likely to conjure up ideas of fancy fresh cuisine, according to history, the first foods were canned in champagne bottles in the 18th century France. Nicolas Appert is credited with creating the canning process along with bouillon cubes and non-acidic gelatin extraction, says the International Food Additive Council. This horse was entry in a French contest to revolutionize food preservation. Eventually, a Appert's process was refined to glass containers and metal tins, sometimes even cast iron. Of course, canned vegetables came before can openers, so opening a can back then was quite the endeavor. It involved chisels and even bayonets. These days, we know more about the science behind canning, and how to keep germs away. You can find canned vegetables and other foods on supermarket and specialty store shelves. While it's true that they can get a bad rap, there are many reasons you should always keep canned vegetables in your pantry. Fresh produce prices are on the rise, but that doesn't mean our nutritional needs have changed. Having canned vegetables on hand is an affordable way to make sure you're eating enough of your recommended daily intake of 5 to 10 fruits and vegetables. We hear you. Eating a canned carrot isn't the same as crunching into a fresh one. However, there are many ways to make most out of your canned veggies and make them taste great, especially if you use one of these canned vegetable hacks you wish you knew sooner. Add acid. Canned vegetables have many benefits. Some of them, such as tomatoes and carrots, are actually more nutritious when canned. Eating canned vegetables allow you to enjoy your favorites even when they are out of season, and the canning process kills off a lot of bad bacteria. Still, there's no denying that canned vegetables do not taste the same as fresh. If you want to get your canned veggies a little closer to the taste of fresh, there are some things you can do. One way to liven up the dullness as accompanied canned vegetables is to hit them with some acid. That acid can come by way of a splash of citrus or vinegar. You can even serve your veggies up with pickles or other fermented foods. According to a study done by researchers at Brandeis University, this works partly because of the sweet and sour flavor receptors that citric acid activates. Bonus tips, acid is a secret ingredient that makes your canned fruit better, even better too. How about beans in your brownies? Who doesn't love dessert? Okay, we know some of you don't, but most people love dessert and are often looking for ways to make these sweet treats just a little bit healthier. This is where the canned vegetables comes in handy. Whether you want to add a nutrient boost to your goodies for yourself or are a parent looking to sneak some more veggies into your kids' diets, this hack is perfect for you. Are you missing a little fiber or protein from your diet? Well, your baked treats will never be the same after adding this surprising ingredient. Pureed beans can be either a fat substitute or a flour substitute. If you want to sub out the fat in your cookies or brownies, only replace 3/4 of your fat with beans. However, if you're using bean puree to make fiber-filled gluten-free treat, you can replace the full amount. Also, pick your bean based on the type of sweet you're making. Black beans for browns, white beans or chickpeas for chocolate chip cookies or brownies. Perhaps cakes are more your speed, but you want a more natural food dye. Try a red velvet cake recipe using canned beets will save you a step, and you're replacing the red dye with a mellow, earthy sweetness. Of course, you can't forget about delicious pumpkin bread and pumpkin pie. You can use them in salads. Using canned vegetables is a great way to stretch your budget and eat your favorite vegetables out of season. But that doesn't mean we don't still crave fresh veggies. Mixing your canned veggies with fresh ones in salads allow you to eat seasonally and locally while staying within budget. The cowboy caviar recipe, for example, uses canned corn and beans, as well as fresh onion and bell pepper, and optional avocado. These minimal fresh ingredients really go a long way towards livening up the canned ones. Serve this special salad on bread or use as a dip for chips. You could also try making a garbage salad, which is a way to use up all the leftovers in your fridge. Do you have some canned olives left over from Taco Tuesday? Are there some canned corn and beans left over from making that cowboy caviar? Great. Mix them in with the fresh veggies you haven't yet used up in this week to create your own culinary masterpieces. When cooking with vegetables, it's not an either-or situation. You can ease your budget by replacing some of your fresh veggies with canned. Save that tomato juice. The canned tomato tip will make your flavor up a notch. Like most of us, you're probably wondering if you should get rid of the liquid when your canned vegetables are sitting in. In the case of canned tomatoes, the answer is a definite no. If your recipe calls for tomatoes and not the juice they're packed in, save that juice and use it later. Think of it as a tomato broth, which means they're way tastier than water when you're making soups or sauces. Tomato juice from a can is best used within a week, but don't worry because it freezes well. Try making tomato ice cubes for easy storage. Once your cubes are frozen, you can pop them out into a freezer bag or container and use them as needed. Canned tomatoes are a fantastic food to have in your pantry. Since they're picked and preserved at their freshest, they really do taste better than the fresh ones you can buy at your local market. Plus, they're available year-round, and a can is good for about 2 years. What's not to love? Save that bean juice. Beans, the magical fruit. The more you eat them, the more uses you find for them. On that note, you should never get rid of the liquid from your canned beans. If you've been on social media, oh boy, what a terrible pun that is, in the last few years, chances are you've seen the word aquafaba. While it may sound fancy, it's really just the cooking liquid from beans. So what do you use aquafaba for? It's handy in vegan cooking, since it's a similar egg replacement that whips up just like egg whites. Thanks to aquafaba, plant-based eaters and those whose egg allergies can now enjoy macaroons, macarons, and meringues. And while you can use the cooking liquid from your home-cooked beans, the aquafaba from canned beans can be more foolproof. Look for this ingredient when buying canned chicken chickpeas for aqua. Kombu. It's a seaweed that stabilizes the aquafaba, meaning you don't have to add your own stabilizer such as lemon juice or cream of tartar. Just make sure you check out the sodium content and adjust your recipes accordingly. Bonus tip. When making hummus, use aquafaba instead of water to thin out the mixture. It will make a world of difference. Add fat. Let's get real here for a second. We know canned vegetables taste a bit different from their fresh counterparts, but why is that? The Encyclopedia of Food Science and Nutrition, second edition, says that during processing for canning, the vegetable cell walls break down. This process is part of what causes the veggies to lose their complexity of flavor. Sometimes companies will use additives to counteract this, but a simple way to get back some of the lost flavor back is to add fat. Butter, bacon, olive oil, these fatty foods all add depth to your canned veggies. Why does this work? Well, fat has a lot of flavors. Study published in the Journal of Neuroscience, the official journal of the Society for Neurosciences, found that primates' brain respond positively to the taste and texture of fat. So yes, your preferences for bacon over broccoli may in fact be totally natural. Make it spicy. There's a huge misconception that just because the vegetables we buy are fresh, they're freshly picked. That's not necessarily true. In fact, some of your supermarket produce may be just as old as its canned counterparts. But that doesn't mean you don't need your canned veggies a flavor boost. Spices and herbs can brighten your canned vegetables and bring out their flavors. It's an easy way to make your canned foods more flavorful. What spices you use depend on a couple of factors: the vegetables you're using and your dish. Naturally, Italian and Mexico flavors pale away with tomatoes. But tomato also pales away with cinnamon, such as in shashuka, poached eggs and sauce. Add fresh dill to your next meal of canned spinach. Or toss off cumin seeds and fresh mint with carrots. If you experiment, you're bound to find flavors you like. Using interesting spice and herb combinations will elevate your canned vegetable sides and mains, helping you forget there was ever a can at all. Add dairy. Adding dairy to your canned vegetables is another hack to make the most of your canned vegetables. The fat in dairy will elevate the mouthfeel of your canned vegetables. Mouthfeel is one of the reasons we love fat. Via the Journal of Neuroscience, the official journal of the Society for Neuroscience, the texture is a critical factor in whether we enjoy food. The book, Food Microstructure and Its Relationship with Quality and Stability, says that the fat content in food is integral to its texture. Dairy is one of the reasons why you should always have canned pumpkin in your pantry. Mixing a bit of pumpkin puree with Greek yogurt is a delicious, slightly sweet treat or breakfast. If you don't do dairy, coconut or cashew yogurt would be the best substitutions here due to their high fat content. Come Thanksgiving, why not try a classic green bean casserole recipe with a can of green beans? These cost-effective options allow you to enjoy your favorite treats and year-round without breaking the bank. Lean into it. At the end of the day, canned vegetables aren't fresh vegetables, which is not a bad thing per se. They're just different beasts. One tactic to deal with canned vegetables is to lean into their canned nature and let them shine for what they are. We all have our strengths and weaknesses, and what better way to celebrate canned veggies than to explore their strengths? For example, canned tomatoes are superior to fresh in almost any application that requires heat. That is why you should always have canned tomatoes in your pantry. Soups, stews, and chilies all work really well with canned vegetables. Since these foods typically cook for a long time, allowing the vegetables to break down the already broken down canned veggies are a natural fit. You'll save prep and cook time by replacing some fresh vegetables with canned ones. To keep your tasting bright, remember to add some fresh garnishes for a pop of color and flavor. Break out your dehydrator. Canning is a great way to preserve vegetables, as is dehydrating. But did you know you can dehydrate canned vegetables? It's pretty simple. Woodlands Medical Society says all you need to do is drain your canned veggies and then place them in your dehydrator. You don't even have to rinse them. They recommend dehydrating canned corn, peas, and beans. You may be wondering why you would do this. Well, cans are heavy, and you might not want to lug around a can of beans on your next hike or camping trip. In fact, you could even make soup out of your dehydrated canned vegetables. So this is a very economical and efficient way to feed yourself the next time you are out in Mother Nature. Of course, not everyone has a food dehydrator, like me. If you don't and you still want to get in this hack, Healthline recommends sun drying, air drying, or using your oven. If you'd like to use your oven, you must set it to 140 degrees Fahrenheit and keep the oven door propped open. Be patient. These measures take time. The oven measure, which is the quickest, can take more than 6 hours. Make canned relish. Of course, we can't talk about canned vegetable hacks without mentioning a home canning hack. And this unusual canned celery recipe is one you probably never heard of, We don't blame you. Celery doesn't come to mind when you hear canned vegetables. Believe it or not, this spice cowrie recipe is more than 100 years old. It was created by Ball, the famous mason jar company that most millennials probably know from their hipster bars. The band released in the cookbook, The Ball Blue Cook of Canning and Preserving Recipes. The recipe is really straightforward. All you do is boil chopped celery, tomatoes, red peppers, vinegar, sugar, and spices. Then you put the mixture in a glass jar and seal it. Bali recommends serving this relish with meat. There are, of course, many other home canning techniques and recipes, but you ought to be very careful when you can food at home. You must follow proper protocol to ensure you don't accidentally welcome botulism into your food, which is why it can be dangerous to make your own canned foods. Blanch them. According to our everyday life, canned vegetables taste the way they do because they're cooked twice, once in a brine or liquid, and then again after they're canned to assure food safety. While this helps them stay shelf-stable and good for a long time, it can make them taste less than fresh. Blanching your veggies can help you get rid of that canned taste. To blanch your veggies, all you have to do is let the vegetables hang out in boiling water for 2 minutes. Drain them and immediately transfer them to ice water. This stops them from cooking more. Now your canned veggies are ready to use and should taste closer to fresh. That case is especially useful in applications where you'll be eating your veggies cold, such as salads or dips. Note, we wouldn't recommend this hack for canned tomatoes, as they will likely lose flavor and fall apart. Roast them. This hack is a simple way to take your canned vegetables to the next level. One of the reasons that canned veggies don't always taste the same as their fresh counterparts is that they absorb a lot of liquid in their cans. That can dilute their flavor and make them mushy. How do you get that excess moisture out of the vegetables? You roast them. The vegan influencer Tabitha Brown is credited with making this method go viral. Brown drains and rinses her canned veggies before roasting them at 475 degrees Fahrenheit. But she's far from the only chef to roast her canned veggies. Different chefs and outlets make other recommendations about temperatures and methodology, but all agree that roasting improves the texture and flavors of your canned veggies. How should you eat your roasted canned veggies? However you'd like. Mix up some oil and spices to your liking, and you're good to go. Get what you need from warranties. They're supposed to protect you if a product you bought is defective, but sometimes they don't. Here are solutions to 6 common problems. Maybe you're shopping for a new refrigerator, one with plenty of space and an ice maker that will churn out cubes for years to come. Perhaps you're seeking a smartphone that won't cost a bundle. Or it's high time to replace your mattress and you're looking for one with just the right firmness. When you're on the hunt for a big-ticket item, one that will cost hundreds or thousands of dollars, you may focus on features, price, and reliability to guide your purchasing decisions. But warranties, a manufacturer's guarantee that the company will repair, replace, or give you a refund for a problematic product within a certain period, are also important to consider before you buy. A good warranty, one that's long, covers key parts into the simple process for resolving problems, indicates that the manufacturer is confident its product will last, says Kevin Brasler, executive editor of Nonprofit Consumers Checkbook, which rates service providers in the U.S. But warranties can vary significantly. Some are short as 90 days, and others stretch for out 10 years or a product's lifetime. And there can be a host of stipulations. For instance, they usually don't cover wear and tear or user errors like a coffee spill that damages a computer. Often there are many exclusions that the warranty is not worth a whole lot, says Amy Schmitz, a consumer law expert and professor at Ohio State Moritz College of Law. Plus, some manufacturers are more likely than others to honor warranties, she says. All of these factors make it essential to read the fine print. The expert advice here can help you navigate. When I went mattress shopping, one brand had a 1-year warranty, another offered a lifetime warranty. Is there any reason not to go with the product with a lifetime one? The mattress with the longer warranty is probably a better value, but that's not always a sure bet, in part because how lifetime is defined may be up to individual manufacturers. Often it means as long as the buyer owns the product, Brasler says, but sometimes it means a period of time that the manufacturer states the product should reasonably be in service. So if a mattress or appliance manufacturer discontinues a product or start making parts for it, it may consider the lifetime to have ended. And while a longer warranty may be better, there's no federal minimum, but some states require at least a year, other provisions are also key. So read carefully before you buy. Some warranties have compensation limitations, so if a sofa begins sagging before its time, for instance, the manufacturer may pay you for its current depreciated value rather than the replacement cost. And sometimes certain parts are excluded, like the digital displays on smart appliances. That means if the display on a smart washer goes haywire 8 months into you buy it, you may have to dig into your own wallet for repairs. In some cases, warranties cover parts, if not labor, or require you pay to send small items, say a multi-cooker, to a repair facility. Often the shipping costs are more than the item is worth, Schmidt says, so that can be tremendously frustrating when you try to exercise your rights under the warranty. Another red flag is a forced arbitration clause. This limits your right to take a company to court if a serious problem with your product arises. It also prevents you from joining a class action suit, Schmidt says. My vacuum isn't picking up dirt and my warranty expired a few weeks ago. Can I still get it fixed without paying for repairs? It's possible. First, do a quick online search using the brand name of the product and the problem. Vacuum has no suction. You may find that certain parts are under a recall or the manufacturer will replay them on request because a number of other consumers had similar issues. Even if no such information comes up, call the manufacturer's customer service department or ask the retailer to help you connect with someone there and clearly describe the problem. While the company no longer has a legal obligation to you, some will extend coverage or offer discounted repairs or a new product as an expression of goodwill. Certain manufacturers, typically those that have a high-end product such as Orvis, Patagonia, or Le Creuset, seem to have robust customer service. Le Creuset, for example, promises to replace defective cookware and give you a piece of equivalent value if the product is no longer being made. If you bought an item with a credit card, check with your card issuer. Many offer warranty protections, typically adding another year to the original warranty. My laptop isn't working right, but the company said I voided my warranty by having an unauthorized repair person work on it a couple months ago. Now what? Warranty should spell out actions that can void coverage. Excuse me, got to turn a page. Such as failing to maintain a product the way the manufacturer specifies, like putting the wrong type of detergent in your dishwasher. But while some companies may claim that out-of-network services or parts void their warranty, in most cases this is illegal under provisions of the Federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. Manufacturers control where you get free in-warranty repairs, but they can't dictate whether you have your product serviced otherwise, Brazzer says. And be aware that states are beginning to pass right-to-repair laws, which may be additional help. Tell the manufacturer is legally required to cover you unless it can prove that an aftermarket part or outside repair person caused the problem, says Nason Proctor, senior director of the Right to Repair campaign at PIRG, a public interest advocacy group. You can also report the company to the Federal Trade Commission, your state's attorney general's office, the Better Business Bureau, says Laurel Lehman, a policy and analyst with Consumer Reports. A salesperson is pushing me to get an extended warranty on the fridge I want to buy. I'm not sure what to do. In most cases, extended warranties are a bad deal for consumers and a big moneymaker for retailers. One survey found that nearly half the people who purchased goods worth more than $500 bought an extended warranty along with it. In 2019, the extended warranty market in the U.S. was worth nearly $50 billion, and it's likely to keep rising. Most extended warranties are really service contracts where you pay a fee ahead of time and then get free or discounted repairs if the product fails after the manufacturer's warranty expires. They may have more restrictions on the type of problems or repairs they cover, Brazzer says, and repairs or replacements may not be very speedy. Plus, retailers often have third parties facilitate these warranties and handle repairs, says Aaron Witt, Director of Consumer Protection at Consumer Federation of America. So it's key to understand what party you're entering into an agreement with, and the warranty may duplicate coverage you already have through your credit card. In many cases, Schmidt says you're better off putting some cash into an emergency fund rather than paying for a service contract you might never use. That's especially likely with smallest, less expensive items. But your decision may also depend on how complex a product is or who's using it. If you're buying a laptop for a 10 who's hard on possessions, an extended warranty might be worth the peace of mind. My six-month-old dishwasher is making strange grinding noises. Why can't I find my warranty anywhere? What should I do? You may be able to download a copy of the warranty from the manufacturer's website. Otherwise, contact the customer service department and give them the information you have, such as a model or product number and date of purchase. Even if you don't have those, the retailer may be able to help. And if you never register your product, don't sweat it. Doing so isn't necessary for your warrant to be in effect. But registering does give you the manufacturer the ability to contact you in case of a product recall, where repairs or replacement could be covered even after warranty expires. Of course, it's always wise to keep your warranty, product serial numbers, and receipts in a convenient spot, at least until the warranty period has ended, even if mostly for your own comfort. My almost new headphones stopped working. I've emailed the manufacturer several times but got no response. Is it within the return window? Ask the retailer to exchange the faulty pair for a new one. Outside of that, gather documents like receipts, and if you can, take a photo or video that shows the problem. Email all of these to the manufacturer's customer service department one more time, along with the description of the issue. That gives you a recent written record. Then call the customer service line, and if the first person you talk to isn't helpful, ask for a supervisor. If you still get nowhere, consider posting something about the problem on the manufacturer's social media, like Facebook or Twitter, asking for help. Many companies have separate customer service teams dedicated to responding to social media posts, and they may be more responsive and eager to make you happy, Schmidt says. Your credit card company may also help you score a chargeback, but only if you already tried to remedy the situation directly with the manufacturer. Your written record will come in handy here. How about a couple of quotable quotes before we close out? The minute you start seeing your obstacles as things that are made for you, to give you what you need, then life starts to get to be fun. You start surfing on top of your problems instead of living underneath them. That's by Ashton Kutcher, who's an actor and investor. That was on Running Wild with Bear Grylls, The Challenge. Growing wealth is not interesting to me. What's interesting is working with people, listening to them, and helping them solve their problems. Doreen Powell Jobs, businesswoman in the Wall Street Journal. I've been so blessed, my tough times will be a dream to someone else. Geno Smith, NFL quarterback in the Seattle Times. Being enthusiastic is worth 25 IQ points, Kevin Kelly, editor, in the book Excellent Advice for Living. My mother always says, know your worth, otherwise someone else will tell you what it is. Emma, a model. And then a quick joke. A small-time rabbi, curious about what people eat pork, wants to try some, but there is nowhere he can go and not be seen. So he travels to a distant town, enters a restaurant, and orders the first pork on the menu. 20 minutes later, the president of his congregation walks in just as his dish arrives, a whole roast pig with an apple in its mouth. The congregation president is shocked, but the rabbi quickly recovers. What a fancy place, he says. Just look how they serve the apple I ordered. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports and etc. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.